While some of them are walk on gears, sure, just clean out the walks. I don't care for none of these. The only thing for me is my bubbling telephone chalice in the morning.
And you're listening to Artists in the City. This is Mally, aka Docu Vixen. This is Roots Reggae Radio. And this is another edition of Artists in the City. Those who are new to the show, this is sort of a space where artists can talk about making independent art, making, the process of making independent art. So we have a special guest, a really awesome guest. I'm excited to have in the studio with us. She is a writer, an activist, and I think an actor now.
Uh-oh. I was going to say you're very kind, but that last one wasn't very nice.
No, you are now, right?
Well, yes, I am, but I'm a bad actor.
No, you're not. So we have in the studio Zainab Amadahi.
Amadahi? This is okay.
Did I say it right? I always butcher people's names. I'm
it's okay.
So we have her in the studio talking about her book, which I'm still reading. I'm getting through. I read like, you know, chapter, you know, a week or something, but it's really good. It's called Wielding the Force, the Science of Social Justice. And she actually was on a book tour, and so maybe tell listeners a little bit about your book.
It's about looking at some cutting edge new and emerging science, and what the implications are for visioning social justice and social justice work. So it's looking at a lot of this science of well-being, for example. I know that there's a lot of kind of new physics and quantum theory and all this kind of thing, but my training, my background is in medical technology. So I'm looking at some of the medical science, mostly the medical science, and some of the implications there. So, for example, you know, looking at the placebo effect, what we know to be the placebo effect and how it's been validated now by all the fancy dancy equipment that we have, you know, fMRI machines and all this kind of stuff. We know that there's actually a reaction in the brain and brain changes and biochemical changes in the body, you know, when people experience what's called the placebo effect, which is reacting to, you know, what used to be considered the sugar pill or whatever. But anyway, so, you know, kind of looking at that mind-body connection and looking at the volumes of, a lot of the research about that, about neuroplasticity and so on, how our brain changes, how our experiences change our brain, and again, the implications for social justice work.
I actually just finished the chapter about, it was like brain tricks, I think.
Yeah.
And how the brain sort of, you can train your brain to, it's constantly sort of rebuilding and changing. Maybe talk a little bit about that and how, I guess like for me, I have, you know, I'm constantly working on having positive thoughts, and it's a big, you know, challenge for me. And so that chapter was basically about, you know, how your thoughts affect your health and well-being, and how that actually affects the brain as well.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and I just want to just say something about the word positivity, because there are so many people that have such a negative reaction to it these days. Thank you to New Agers for that. But, and I'm not talking about, you know, happy for no reason or just smile your way through life. I am talking about emotional health, which is up and down. But anyways, in terms of neuroplasticity, I open that chapter in the book by looking at the work of Pascual Alvarez Leone, who's actually an American scientist, who did some work looking at how the brains of people developed when they were learning how to play the piano. So they spent an hour a day for 5 days learning to play the piano, and what he found after 5 days, only 5 days, was that the part of the brain that was responsible for finger movement had changed quite dramatically. So there were more neurons, more brain cells, more connections between the brain cells, so more communication, more blood supply, and that whole area of the brain had developed significantly. But even more remarkably, the next thing that he did was he wanted to see how just thinking about the piano, playing the piano, would impact the brain. And so he had a group of people, volunteers, again, for 5 days, for an hour a day. They would come and they would not move their fingers at all, but they would only think. They would close their eyes and think about playing the piano. And he found that just thinking about playing the piano when you actually had no piano in front of you elicited the same kind of brain changes that you saw in people who were actually learning to play the piano. So it's just an example of again, the mind-body connection. There's many, many examples in the book that come out of the medical record. And so what the reason that I was kind of interested in this is because my concern is about, you know, well, for example, things like angry activism, you know, people who are who come to activism and social justice work from, you know, and we all have negative experiences. I mean, some of us more than others, of course, you know, depending on what we've had to deal with in life. You know, we have to be careful not to allow that to motivate our anger. And I used to hear a lot, you know, that people would say, let your anger, you know, like, you know, motivate you to do your work. But that's actually not very helpful. So there's more and more evidence. I'm writing a second book now that looks, you know, this one kind of looked at the wielding the force, kind of looked at some of the theoretical things, but the new book is looking at some very practical information about how you can actually do this, how you can actually, you know, shift your brain. I mean, shift the way your brain looks and functions, shift your what they call a set point, your emotional set point, and all this kind of thing. And I look at it less for individuals, because there's a lot of stuff out there that looks at individual well-being and looks at this new science in terms of individual physical health and cognitive development. But I look at, well, what's the impact on collective work, on collaborative work, on group work? And so there's some new science that's looking at that. And what we actually do find is that, you know, if you can, as a group, hold on to optimism, if you can vision and share that vision, an optimistic vision of the future that you're working towards and various other things that I'll be talking about, it actually really does impact the work. It makes it more effective. It gets things done. You know, it keeps the group more cohesive and many, many other good things that we want. You know, this is the kind of society we want to build, and we have to start role modeling it. Yeah.
And that kind of leads into something that I wanted to touch on also is, I guess, you know, sort of collective or cultural sort of motivations for things. So, you know, how we in our culture, in our consumerist culture, we kind of, what am I trying to say? Things like competitiveness, anger, and all this stuff is sort of valued more, or like there's more sort of. So maybe talk a little bit about that. Yeah.
Well, definitely, you know, mainstream culture values competition. I mean, we're told all the time, you know, in a capitalist society, you know, it's all about, you know, the cream rising to the top and all this nonsense, right? And we're also taught to be very individualist as well, you know, that we, you know, we don't owe our existence or our well-being or our success to anyone or anything. And, you know, we're just kind of, you know, these self-made man type of stereotypes and myths that we're fed and in the society. And yes, there are you know, other myths. I mean, there are counterculture myths and so forth and so on. But when you look at what society values, you know, I mean, if you look at how they value, I mean, it's usually through money is how you can tell what this society values. And, you know, again, these, you know, competitive enterprises and competitive ideas, you know, are really quite glorified and appreciated. But the reality is that even, you know, the best capitalists collaborate and cooperate. And, you know, I guess they don't want us to focus on that so much, right? Because, you know, their philosophy is that, you know, they're in competition with everything and everyone. But the reality is even in the business world, people who collaborate and cooperate do well. You know, I hate to tell them that because I don't want them to necessarily do well. But yeah, I mean, cooperation, we're built for it. We're made for it biologically. We get all kinds of payback from cooperating or even watching people cooperate and collaborate together and work together. You know, there's changes to our biochemistry. Some of the changes are increased what they call DHEA, which, you know, has so many positive health benefits, increases in oxytocin, which are responsible for our capacity to bond, to create connections and personal connections, nitrous oxide, which is laughing gas, but our body makes it naturally. And again, you know, a lot of health benefits from the more we have in our body. So, I mean, those are just some examples, you know, that watching people cooperate and successful cooperation, collaborations actually improve our health and improve our problem-solving capacities, improve our creative capacities as well, and reshape our brain so that it becomes easier, you know, to cooperate, and we become wired in a sense. We can wire ourselves for cooperation. Yeah.
Well, maybe talk a little bit how the brain, you know, actually rewires it, perpetually rewires itself.
Right. Well, the brain does change from moment to moment, but the more you focus on something, the more you do something, the more you think in a certain way, the more the brain and other parts of your body, but it's just that the brain, the information around the brain is new, so we didn't know this. For example, when I was in medical technology, you know, I was told that, you know, the brain kind of, you know, once you're at the age of 24 at the latest, your brain was kind of set in stone, and you couldn't really change anything, you know, without Herculean efforts, like a lot of effort into doing it. But now we know, no, that's not true. I mean, there are people in their 90s that are literally reshaping their brains to facilitate whatever it is they need and want to facilitate. So, for example, stroke victims, you know, nowadays, you know, are being supported with different kinds of therapies, new therapies, to be able to regain functions that they might have lost. So the brain will actually change the area. I mean, for example, if, you know, the part of the brain that is responsible for walking, or the parts of the brain responsible for walking have been damaged, you know, you can actually train other parts of the brain to pick up that function. And we don't know what the limits are. I mean, you know, clearly there are limits, but we don't know what they are, and some remarkable things are happening. A lot of this work has been done in the area of mental health, where people who have, you know, been able to, you know, do mindfulness-based meditation. It's as simple as that, and other types of techniques and therapies, and they, you know, have been able to go off their meds and this kind of thing. Anyways, so the more that we focus on something, the more that our brain reshapes itself to facilitate what we're focused on. There's a downside to that too, because, or maybe not, it depends on what we're focusing on and not focusing on, but, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. And I think of, for example, those residential school survivors who, you know, weren't allowed and were punished for speaking their language quite harshly. I mean, with pins through the tongue and all this kind of really harsh stuff when they were children. And you'll hear some of them say today that they have forgotten how to speak their language, you know, because, you know, they weren't allowed to, and they had no one to speak it with, and so on. So, and they were traumatized, you know, and the brain reacts, you know, in very interesting ways, you know, to trauma. Again, trauma does, you know, reshape the brain. So not permanently, but it does reshape the brain. So, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. But also the good news for us is that you can also get it back. And you can also move forward. You know, all you have to do, I mean, I don't want to make it sound simple, but, you know, it is a matter of practice and consistency. And I think, you know, in terms of healing, if I might go on, I know I'm talking a bit, but I look at, in the book, I look at some of the indigenous, global indigenous ways of healing, which relied a lot on that mind-body connection, not exclusively, because people had, you know, other types of ways of dealing with illness too, but they always combined it with the mind-body connection. And they didn't think about the limits. They didn't think about, so we have stories in our community of people who have been, you know, broken their backs, to be quite extreme about it, and been told they'll never walk again, who wheel themselves into, you know, a healing ceremony and will walk out, kind of thing, you know. So, you know, yeah, so that's basically what we look at in the book, yeah.
Maybe for listeners who don't know, maybe tell a little bit about your experience, your life experience, and so people have a little bit better of who you are.
Who the hell I am? yeah, well, I was born in the States. I am part African-American, part Cherokee, or Chilaki, as the word is spoken there, Aniumwia in the language, and part European. My family, originally both the Cherokee and the African side of my family, we can trace back to the Reynolds Tobacco Plantation in Staunton, Virginia, and that's as far back as we have any information about. I was born in New York City. My parents were kind of activists during the Civil Rights era, the AIM movement, the American Indian Movement era, and they were quite active. My mother likes to say that I was an activist before I was born, because I think she said she was 6 months pregnant when she went to a demonstration, and they were spitting on her and all this kind of thing. So I guess I kind of had no choice. I kind of was born into the situation. And I was really quite angry. I grew up in a context where there was an awful lot of violence, an awful lot of racism, kind of not different from now, actually. But anyways, but you know, I mean, I was living, my family was quite impoverished, and so yeah, I mean, little, really, really impoverished. I mean, there were days that my mother didn't eat so that we could, kind of thing. So I grew up to be really, really angry, and I was an activist. I guess I was kind of branching out on my own as an activist in high school and doing some things. So that's kind of my background, and because of my own experiences, you know, becoming ill, and also I was really, really lucky, and I'm so grateful that I had access to indigenous teachings and elders in the community here in Toronto, because that just kept me alive, you know, and kept me hopeful and optimistic. So I had to go through some shifts. I can't say that there was a turning point where things changed on a dime, but I just kept learning and growing and experiencing. And I guess being ill was kind of a turning point, you know, there were a lot of kind of turning points, and that's how I got to where I am today. Yeah.
So what was your process of writing the book? And, you know, maybe tell a little bit, because you've been touring the book, maybe a little bit about that experience. I haven't really heard.
Yeah. Well, the process of writing the book, it's hard for me to kind of, you know, talk about a beginning to it, because it's kind of been in process my whole life in some ways. But, you know, again, it was, you know, partly it was being sick and trying to research, you know, what I needed to be able to heal myself. It was being an activist and kind of crashing as an activist and burning out and exploring that. It's partly being a science fiction writer and coming, like, intersecting with, you know, in terms of my research, finding, you know, some of this new cutting edge stuff that isn't out there in the mainstream yet. It's not being taught in schools very much. Partly, I think, because it takes about 15 years before new discoveries make it into mainstream education and so on. But also because I think a lot of the science is not something that you can profit off of. And so, you know, it's hard getting the research dollars, and it's hard convincing people who want to make a buck, you know, that this is real, or that they should try it, kind of thing, or that they should use it in clinical practice. So anyway, so that kind of led me in a sense to some of the writing. But I would say that probably the most important factor at the risk of sounding like a crazy person, was some experiences that I had in ceremony, some experiences that I had with my ancestors who really pushed me in this direction. I don't think this is the end. I don't think I can, you know, kind of rest on the laurels of this book. I have to continue to work, of course. But I really feel it was made very, very clear to me in many ceremonies and experiences that my ancestors, at least, and Mother Earth, I think, wants this information out there, that we as a human species can really benefit from it and can use it. In terms of the book's reception and the touring, I haven't actually done a lot of launches in Canada yet. I'm hoping to do that, but almost as soon as the book came out, I went to New Zealand with it. It was a kind of a nice excuse to visit one of my sons who lives there these days, but I just had an awesome time doing workshops that were connected with the book, radio interviews and so on, and it was received really, really well. Maori people, of course, you know, recognize a lot of the principles and, you know, the ideas around mind-body connection. And, you know, just everybody was so pleased, you know, I mean, those who read the book, you know, had really positive feedback for me and really embraced me in terms of the workshops and the speaking gigs that I had there. So I'm really encouraged, and I hope that, you know, that experience is reproduced in Canada, not just because I would love to sell books, because this is a self-publication, but also because, as I say, I really think that, and I'm not the only person doing this work by any stretch, but I do think that we need this information out there. Yeah.
I liked what I read, and one thing that I kind of wanted to actually talk about was the idea of like how we make decisions based on emotion or feelings.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if we don't have any feelings about a certain situation, it's kind of hard to make that decision.
It's impossible, actually. There's a PBS series. It's a documentary series. It's called The Human Brain or something, The Compassionate Brain, something like this. Anyways, it's cited in the book. And there's one chapter there that looks at a man. They look at several people but the one that sticks in my mind was this middle-aged man who had a stroke and parts of his, the emotional centers of his brain were damaged. And he was completely incapable of making a decision. He couldn't, you know, decide what to have for breakfast, when to get up in the morning, you know, whether to shower, what to wear. His wife was making all those decisions for him. And what we know from his case and many other situations is that if you're not able to associate a feeling with the outcome of a decision, and which is important to activists, not that it is, I mean, that isn't, but what's important to activists is that you can't actually argue a point of view or even have a point of view, take a point of view. You can't, you know, develop an ideology or argue a case for anything if you can't associate an emotional feeling with a logical conclusion, with an outcome of that line of thought or that logic. So, yeah, the emotional centers of the brain have to be involved. And we know now that it's more than the brain, that there's a lot of stuff going on in the body, you know, when we feel stuff. But, you know, in academia, you know, my experience and many other people's experience in academia is we're somehow supposed to separate our head from our hearts, you know, which is, it's impossible. It's just impossible. And I don't know where we got this idea. It's certainly not an idea that elders from indigenous communities across the globe endorse or believe in. I've always been told to be heart-led, to follow my heart and make decisions from the heart, in the heart, and all this kind of terminology. So think with my heart. And there's truth in that. There's real truth in that just in terms of the way we're built as human beings. It's impossible to make a decision or make a logical argument or hold an opinion without involving the emotional centers of our brain.
So with that, like, you know, we're taught to actually, how damaging is that we're taught to cut that part out of our lives? And how are people moving in the world because of that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sure we all have our stories about that. I mean, because we all have our individual struggles, you know, around, you know, feeling our emotions, showing our emotions, you know, and acting, you know, after, you know, after we've repressed our emotions for so long or denied them or whatever, they just gain strength and people get ill. People, you know, various kinds of illnesses from repressing and denying emotions. So, you know, there's a huge consequence to that. We also, in the book, I talk as well about right and left brain and the different responsibilities that the right and left brain have. Now, in reality, are the hemispheres of the brain actually work together. And the more that they work together, it's called brain integration, the more we benefit, again, cognitively and physically in terms of our health and well-being. But as we know, in mainstream society, many of these institutions, not the least of which is our education system, really ask us, or they're only concerned with left brain skills, right? And so they're concerned with, you know, measuring and counting and quantifying and reducing things to their component parts and all this kind of stuff. Our brains are capable of much more, but it's the left brain skills that are really developed in our institutions and in our educational system. And, you know, it's most of us, you know, kind of because of neuroplasticity, that those kinds of skills are often developed at the expense of right brain skills. And the right brain skills are, you know, more creative and artistic and more emotional and holistic and all this kind of thing. So I kind of look at this in the book. The context in which I bring it up in the book is to look at ideologies and to look at worldviews. And, of course, as I said, mainstream culture values these left brain values, these left brain abilities far more. But there are other cultures in the world that value both sides of the brain. You know, as a result, I mean, indigenous cultures, as we know, are not very valued, are kind of dismissed and considered backward or in the way of progress because they are more balanced, which is quite ironic. So they're closer to... anyways, yeah, so it's problematic for people, yeah, and I'm sure everybody who's listening probably has a story about that, yeah.
Because I, you know, that's something that, you know, I've been told you're too emotional and, you know, like, why do you talk about your emotions all the time? I'm like, well, what else are you talking about? I don't know.
Yeah.
So, and then also I wanted to actually touch on, you know, which you kind of talk about in the book as well, is, you know, sort of how that's connected to sort of the environment and how that's connected to other, you know, people and other beings and, you know, how our sort of... we're connected. And I mean, for example, I guess relating it to my experience, when there's a lot of, you know, weather stuff that goes on, I feel affected, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how you know, sort of how those kind of other people's emotions affect you individually as well. And you kind of touch on that in the book as well.
Yeah. Well, there are, you know, spiritual traditions and cultural teachings that have known this for a very long time. But if we just want to talk about the science that's coming out, it's really on the cusp. It's really, you know, at the very early stages of understanding how we as human beings are connected to each other, connected to other life forms, and connected to the planet herself and even beyond. One of the ways that I look at in the book is by looking at our energy fields, our electromagnetism, particularly the electromagnetism that's given off by the heart. And what happens when we're feeling anything, when any thought crosses our brain or any feeling, you know, emerges, there are shifts in what's called the heart rate variability. And with those changes in our heart rate variability, which is the intervals between heartbeats, the electromagnetism or the energy that's given off by the heart also changes. And so these emotional shifts are encoded. There's emotional information encoded in the energies that we radiate at all times. So I talk about the heart one because it's the largest one that our body gives off. It's the largest energy field that our body gives off. And right now we can measure, well, the last time I checked, we can measure up to 6 feet outside of the body. It continues to go on after that and intersect with other energies that we're surrounded by, of course. But and by the way, things are changing so quickly in the science that, you know, from 1 week to the next, you're getting, you know, new and better stories that validate this. But anyways, I talk in the book about some of the work that's done by the HeartMath Institute, where, you know, you put two people in the same room together, and their heart EM fields will sync up. And in fact, you'll find even the same patterns that start out in one person's heart EM EM vibration, you'll see that same pattern in their EEG, their brain wave pattern. So our hearts can communicate heart to heart. Our hearts can communicate heart to brain across people, across species, even with some of the work that they've done with a boy and his pet, his dog. There's some work being done as well, you know, with plants and water and all kinds of other things. At the Institute of Noetic Sciences, I was reading the other day, this didn't make the book, but the idea is in the book. And what they have done is they've separated partners, people who are in a life partnership. They've separated them into different rooms, and they put them both in fMRI machines, and they asked one person to send, you know, love and care and concern to the other person in the other room. And what happened was that the person in the other room, their brain reacted as though they were being told this by their partner. So the same kind of brain reaction that you would see if two people were in the same room looking at each other and one said, I love you, I really care for you, and all this kind of stuff. You know, we could see that message being transmitted non-verbally with a wall in between these two people. There are other far more remarkable things going on, remarkable experiments. But in terms of the weather and how you react and all that kind of thing, we have to remember that all of life, there's many, many energies that are being radiated by all forms of life, including the Earth. The Earth radiates her own electromagnetic field. And there are changes in that electromagnetic field, you know, with solar energy, with gravitational shifts, with changes in weather. And even what came to the attention of the HeartMath people, the Institute of HeartMath, was I'll just tell you two incidences if you don't mind me carrying on like this. No. But what happened, we have all kinds of weather satellites and everything in the sky right now, kind of looking at shifts in the Earth's electromagnetic field, among other things. But what they found was a very, very dramatic shift on two occasions that I'll just talk about. One was during 9/11, not at the time of the attacks, but at the time when the attacks were broadcast by media. There was a huge, huge shift in the Earth's magnetic field. Another time that happened was when Obama, at his first election, came out to make his acceptance speech. Again, a huge, huge shift in the Earth's magnetic fields. So there was field. So there are there's an experiment underway to look now to see how groups of people might have an impact on the Earth's EM field. And we already know that the Earth changes in the Earth's EM impact us, right? We already know that. That's not disputed much, although you'll find in science there are always some holdouts somewhere, somehow, you know, that don't agree with something. But it's not seriously disputed anymore that the Earth's EM field does impact, you know, our physiology and our mood as a result. So those are some of the things we look at in the book.
So maybe tell listeners how they could get in contact with the book, and how they could, because it's self-published, right?
It is self-published, and hopefully it'll be more widely available. But right now, if you go to my website, it's swallowsongs.com, www.swallowsongs.com. And there you'll find links on all of my pages where you can find either the print book, the hard copy, or the ebook. It's available at amazon.com and Smashwords. But the easiest way, and also if you go to my site, which you're going to find as well, are a bunch of freebies. So you'll get an excerpt from the book. You'll get other articles that I've written on this topic and others that all relate to social justice work. So I think, you know, for people who are interested in this topic and may not be able to afford the book at this moment, you'll still get a lot of information off of my site. So that's www.swallowsongs.com.
Plug your, you know, Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, and feel free to friend me on Facebook and Twitter. Yeah. Zainab Amarahi.
Yes. My question was, you know, with this sort of like shift or, you know, slow shift of what do you think that's a cause of, like this new shift into relational science or paradigm, like you say in the mm-hmm. book? What's the shift going on, and what is there a shift, or is it just still in the outskirts?
Well, I think we can talk about a shift. Even the scientists are starting to talk about a shift in consciousness that's based on what they're finding out, these newer discoveries that, you know, validate ideas of interconnectedness and all this kind of thing, not just between us, but between us and our environment. But our elders, you know, elders in so many communities have known that things are shifting right now anyways. I mean, you know, people talk about the Mayan, you know, calendar and the predictions and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, the Mayans, of course, are not the only one that recognized that, you know, this would be a moment. And I have my own theories about what's going on, but I do feel that you don't have to be, you know, a spiritual person or a scientist to sort of recognize that things, you know, things are changing and things have to change and they should change because, you know, the earth, you know, we can't rape and pillage anymore. You know, I mean, we're going to be running out of resources, you know, and that alone is enough of an impetus, I think, for people to start shifting their awareness and their consciousness and their practices as a result. Yeah. I hope that's the answer you were looking for, more or less.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I just... I see the sort of like, you know, things that were looked as sort of, they weren't validated before, and they're starting to, like all of a sudden scientists are like, oh yeah, everybody who was saying this for like millennia is right. You know, like what's that about, you know?
Exactly. So, yeah. Exactly. Well, it is interesting that, you know, truth can't be denied, you know, and so even following these linear ways of you know, scientific method, I mean, not, you know, again, I don't want to say that indigenous peoples were not scientists. I mean, there's, you know, some, you know, concern about using that word, and I think from one end, you know, people think that indigenous ways of knowing are folkloric and, you know, and mythology and superstition at the same time that they're trying to steal it and sell it. But anyways, so that's one side, and they don't like to use the word science when they're talking about indigenous knowledge ways. On the other side, you know, there are indigenous people that think that the term science is far too limited to describe the knowledge ways and practices. But yeah, so it is very interesting to me to, you know, that truth, as I say, cannot be kind of suppressed, and that even, you know, these linear ways and these, you know, I maybe shouldn't say Eurocentric, but, you know, most recently these are Eurocentric ways of, you know, doing science that have been imposed on the rest of the world. And even those ways are beginning to conclude the same thing as you know, sages did millions of years ago. Well, not millions, thousands of years ago. I don't know about millions. I don't know what survives from millions of years ago. But
yeah, anyway. I don't think we were around, right? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we were, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. We were around in spirit for damn sure.
So maybe let's talk about what's coming up for you. What are you working on?
I see that mischievous smile of yours. Well, I have a couple of other books I'm working on. As I mentioned before, there's another booklet kind of coming out with some practical ideas about how groups can actually make use of this knowledge to, you know, to be more effective and to be more cohesive as groups. So I'm talking activist groups, community groups, artistic groups, whatever. So that's going to be coming out really shortly before the end of the year, probably in the fall. And then I'm working on a series of fiction, science fiction books. Science fiction is my first love. I can't put it down. And it's going to be a trilogy of stories about a future Toronto where, the economic crash has happened and folks are trying to rebuild society. And, we have a few holdouts in terms of these corporate empires that are still trying to hold on and take. So that's coming out. The series is called Nanotales because it focuses a lot on nanotechnology and some of the uses that could be put to and not. And then the one you're probably smiling, that devilish smile about, is a project that I have that I wrote a film. It originally was supposed to be a short film. It's called Alien Night, and it satirizes terrorphobia. It's a kind of a sci-fi comedy. And there's a producer and a director, and we start shooting next week. And I didn't write it as a vehicle for me at all, but they had some difficulty finding an actor to do one of the main parts, and so they convinced me that I could act. So we're going to see if that's true.
That's so exciting. I'm so excited for you. I know you're like nervous about it, but I think you're going to do really well.
I hope so. Thank you.
So I think we're going to just take a musical break and then we'll come back and wrap up. And then, yeah, you're listening to Roots Reggae Radio. I said, God bless you if you wanted to. You can choose your own. It's up to you. It's a stranger world for lovers too. So God bless you and it's up to you. I You're listening to Roots Reggae Radio, and this is Artists in the City. My name is Mali, aka DocuVix, and in studio with me is
Zainab Amarahi.
And we have been talking about her book, Wielding the Force, The Science of Social Justice. And this was a self-published book. So for all those other writers out there, this is sort of like, you know, option that, you know, artists can actually and writers can actually do. So maybe talk a little bit about what it took to self-publish.
Yeah, I have been published by publishers in the past, but this is my first self-publication, and I had a number of reasons for doing it, and there are many, you know, and there are also many routes to self-publishing. On my website, you're going to find some information about that, but yeah, I guess some of the main reasons that people self-publish are, for one thing, the timelines. The very first book that I published in the 90s, I published with Sister Vision Press, which isn't around very right now. But, you know, and this isn't an extraordinary experience, but from the time that I put the period, you know, on the last page of that manuscript to the time I actually held the book in my hand, it was about 3 years. And that's fine if you're willing to wait, you know, that time. And, you know, this was a fiction book. It was no biggie. But I didn't feel like I wanted to wait 3 years for my book to come out. And there's no guarantee that 3 years is all you'll wait either. It could be a lot longer. The other reason that people self-publish is because, you know, you spend all that time and energy, particularly with nonfiction, but there's a lot of research and work that goes into writing a book. And, you know, you never get your money back anyways, right? I mean, unless you, like, sell it to Hollywood or something. But sell the rights to Hollywood. But, you know, again, if you want to recoup, you know, be remunerated for the time and the energy and the effort and the work that goes into this, into these writings, then, you know, self-publishing allows you to do that. You do have to spend some money up front getting things edited, and please edit if you're self-publishing, please edit, because, you know, and hire somebody else to edit, because, you know, the best of writers make mistakes. You know, you should even have more than one edit if you can afford it. Yeah, so you do spend a little money up front, you know, sometimes if you want fancy cover art or whatever. But, you know, the technology makes it really, really easy these days, and you can recoup the money. And, you know, again, for people that do it, I still think that publishing houses have their role to play. But for people who want to self-publish, I really, really encourage you to do it. I've had a wonderful experience with it. And, you know, I'm happy to work with other people who want to collaborate on promoting, you know, relevant books that are relevant to what I write, social justice and the other things that I write. And I think the more we cooperate, as I mentioned before, the better things are. There's a lot of work. Don't be fooled and think that, you know, books sell themselves, that if you put it out there, somehow they're going to, like, all you have to do is worry about how good the book is and quality sells, because even crap will sell if you put the energy into it. So you really have to learn. I loved what Molly told me the other day. She, you know, the words that people use for this type of thing are marketing and book promotion and things like this. But I really love the term that she used, which is, you know, developing a relationship with your audience, because that's really what we're doing. So, yeah, it gives you the opportunity, I think, to, interact with your readers in a much more meaningful way, in a much more hands-on way than going through a publishing house. But it is work. You can also hire people to do things, but please, you know, do your research find out, you know, how to promote books, which you're going to have to do anyways with a publishing house anyways. It's just that they can help you do it. But if you're on your own, you have to find your own help. But it's out there. It's out there in many, many different forms, so it's certainly possible. Yeah.
So what is that pushing your book look like for people?
Developing a relationship with your audience.
Interacting with your audience.
Yeah. I think the first thing you have to decide when you're self-publishing is, who are you writing for? Who are you writing for? You know, I mean, a lot of people like to think that, you know, they're just writing for everybody and anybody who's interested. But you really have to know who you're writing for. You have to You know, in my case, because my audience was mainly social justice activists and other artists and you know, community workers and folks of color and all those kinds of things. And because I interact in those circles, I didn't have to do a lot of research around, you know, what types of things people would read, what kinds of things they needed to be able to, you know, and wanted to be more effective at their work and so on. But these are the kinds of questions that you should have answered before. And it doesn't mean necessarily that you're not going to write what you want to write or that you're writing to satisfy a market, but it's more about how you say what you say, whether or not you can identify that there's a need out there for the words that you want to put to paper. You know, you need to, I mean, if you want to sell books, you have to be satisfying a need. You have to be helping people out in some way. You have to be offering solutions to problems that exist. So you have to know what those solutions are. You have to know, you know, what the problems are, and you have to be able to write in a way that you know is accessible to your peeps, right? So yeah,
know your audience.
And after that, you know, there's so many ways. I mean, again, it's so easy these days, you know, with online. I mean, not that you can just exclusively go online, but there are many people that do very well online. I mean, there's all kinds of options available, and, you know, social media is free. Blogging is free. There's techniques that you can Google, you know, book promotion, and you'll have all kinds of gurus out there, and you don't have to pay a cent for the information. And all my advice is just take it one step at a time. You know, try, you know, depending on what you're good at, try the things that you already have the skills for while you're learning things that you don't have the skills for. And just take it one step at a time, because when you're trying to develop a relationship with an audience, there are a million things you could be doing, but you're not going to be good at any of them if you try doing them all at once. So take them in stages, you know. And once you get one, you know, once the website's under control, move to social media. Once the social media is under control, move to, you know, workshops or whatever works for you. Yeah.
That's another thing you do. Do you have any workshops coming up at all?
Well, I have some stuff coming up in August in Ottawa. The other things that I have are not really public gigs, but so there'll be more information about that on my site very soon. But yeah, in August, so I'll be launching at Octopus Books on August the 21st, and there's another couple of days. There's another publication that I'm a part of. It's an anthology called Honoring Indigenous Women, Hearts of the Nation, Volume 2. So there's a launch for that as well in Ottawa, and there'll be another launch here in Toronto in the fall. So I guess you could say I'm busy.
It's good busy.
Delightfully though. Busy,
yeah. Thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you for putting up with me.
And welcome. Yeah, you're welcome to come back to Roots Reggae Radio.
I would love to. Thank you so much, Melly.
Okay. And we're heard here every Thursday, 6 to 7-ish. Sometimes, you know, the universe doesn't have us on time, but, you know, we're always here. And if you want to go to our website and contact around our website, the website is artistsinthecity.wordpress.com. And, of course, tune in to rootsreggaeradio.com. And we'll see everybody next week.
There'll always be someone complaining. People have so much to say, but you and me.